Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Day Christensen, and several years ago, I met her in Mysore, India, and we practiced together, and we got to know each other a little bit. And, you know, she runs a Mysore program in Miami, and she travels the world and teaches workshops, and I really wanted to have her on the show, and it took a little, scheduling stuff to, like, figure it out, and we figured it out. And so, Day, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So let's get into the thick of it. I want to know who Day was when she first walked into yoga. Like, how did you even show up to class?
Yeah. In high school, I was super athletic and very, very, very physical, my whole life. And then, I kind of got swayed in the direction of making art. My whole family is very artistic. And, I started working on a portfolio to go to college, and I wound up at the School of the Art Institute, and then kind of hated that and went to UIC, which is a more conceptual school. And when I was making art, I was it was my excuse to be physically lazy. So I basically, what happened was I was working, putting myself through school for the most part, with a little bit of help and a little bit of loans, but mostly I was paying for it. And, so all I was doing was working and going to school. And of course, what happens when you're in college and in art school, especially, is you get, a little unhealthy.
Right.
You gain the 15, the freshman 15 and all
freshman
that.
15?
Yeah.
That happened to you?
Yeah, it happened. Okay. It happened. I lost it. I gained it. I lost it. And it was the first time in my life that I was feeling super unhappy and disconnected from my body. But nonetheless, that's what I was doing for about 7 years. And, something hit me one day where I was just all this work that I'm doing doesn't really matter if I don't feel good. So I kind of had a quarter life identity crisis. And I thought, no matter what I'm going to do as a profession, I thought I have to make sure that one third of my life that is spent working, that I'm enjoying it and that I'm staying physically fit.
Yeah.
And
what athletics did you do though? You said before, you were do something competitively?
Yeah, I did. Well, I was on team sports forever. Basketball was my favorite, but volleyball, softball, I swam. I was like a monkey. I climbed everything. I did everything. And then I went from being super, super active to just flatlining. Yeah. I just thought, my parents, my mom always did what she wanted to do, didn't make a ton of money, but was super happy. My dad, who felt maybe more responsibility to take care of the family, had a better job and was miserable. And I kind of was I don't want to be miserable. If it just means having money, I'm just going to follow my passion. And it turned into I'm too old for team sports. And I was already reading and very much in an academic space. And so I started reading about yoga and yoga philosophy, and I connected with it. And I promised myself that as soon as I got through school that I was going to start doing yoga. And that's
wow.
It. Yeah.
And so did you walk into an Ashtanga class the very first time that you did it?
Wouldn't have that been amazing if I did
it
that?
It would have been amazing. I mean, yeah. It would have made a great story for the podcast.
Yeah, if I just walked into a Mysore room and then just pressed up into a handstand my first day. That would be the story. But no, that's not what happened. I just started going to a free class. It was a community class at it was a studio in Chicago that's still there, Moksha Yoga.
Gotcha.
And there's this, that free class. And I just said, you know what? It's free. I have, of course, had no money. And, so I just said, I'm just going to go to the free class once a week. And the free class was always taught by somebody new. So I got like this variety of teachers and styles. And of course, like my first few classes were very frustrating because I didn't know what I was doing, because I was a little chubby. I was a little bit like, you know, everything. My hamstrings were super tight. Everything was painful. And I was like,
I mean, it hurts like hell.
It hurts. Yeah, it hurt. Yeah. That's a really good way of describing it. Like the first few classes were painful. I definitely didn't enjoy them. But I really already felt like, God, yoga is like the answer. It just felt like, you know, I'm using my body. There's no equipment. There's no, it was free. It just seemed like this was, and the philosophy part was there. And it just seemed like this is clearly the path.
Yeah, so, that's great.
Yeah. So that's what I did. And I was doing like once a week for a couple months doing that free class. And then I was like, okay, I think I have to get more serious about it. So that started feeling better because every week my hamstrings were just tight again. It was just,
right.
You know, it wasn't enough.
Wasn't enough, no.
Yeah. So I started going to twice a week. I started paying for like a class package and then using my one class and then getting a free class. I was doing that for a couple more months. And then I was like, okay, I got to do more. And because I kept being so consistent, I basically got like a work study position where you work at the studio in exchange for classes. And that's,
oh, yeah, of course.
That's basically how I started practicing from twice a week to every day.
And was there a strong compulsion to practice every day? Like, could you have done like, or did you make that transition fast?
I made that transition after probably 4 or 5 months of practicing like once or twice a week. Yeah. I just said, you know what? Damn it. that's the only way that I'm going to start feeling better. And I was desperate to feel better in my body after so many years of feeling what it was like to feel disconnected and lethargic and a bit overweight and just unhappy and uncomfortable and not proud of who I was. And I was desperate to feel that again. So I thought, right, I'm just going to go. It's basically like replacing one addiction with another, which I think you could probably relate to. My addiction being a bit of laziness, maybe watching TV or screwing around on the internet when I had free time, or just not sleeping enough, drinking too much coffee. Of course, there was drinking and some mild drug use involved at that time, but nothing crazy. But it was just a lifestyle that you become so complacent. And I was just like, I can't. So it was like literally, I just did a 180 degree turn and said, now I'm going to change my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that was like when you were about 25?
Yeah, I started when I was 24.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so what year was that? Not that I'm trying to date you or anything.
No, that's okay.
Trying to get a concept.
That's okay. I was 24 in 2004.
Okay. Gotcha. And so then how did you show up to your first Ashtanga class?
After a couple of months of just doing the free class and doing whatever fit my schedule, I started having a little bit more flexibility to try other things. Of course, I started, I was freelance. I was working for myself after I graduated college. And I decided to try out everything. And I went to like a guided Ashtanga class. And that was truthfully pretty boring to me at the time. And I think that it was super boring because I wasn't doing half of it. So I was like,
because you couldn't do it?
Yeah, you couldn't. If you can't do something, you're just kind of plopping your butter, you know, in between seated poses, just like kind of like plopping on the mat and not really doing anything. So there's no connection to like, wow, this is actually like a really strong, hard practice. It doesn't feel strong or hard because you're not doing any of it. Right. At least that was my experience. So I kept doing vinyasa classes for a while. I mean, when I'm talking, it was so fast. I probably started doing a Mysore practice 6 months in.
Wow.
But I really like I said, I went from like 0 to 100 real quick, like Drake. Yeah.
Like, you just quoted Drake.
Yeah, I did. I did. Which
that's all good. That's kind of what I do too. So
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. So that was that. And, I don't know, something kind of like, well, Keno McGregor came to town, Chicago. And at that point, I was practicing a lot. I was working there. I was working at the studio. I was actually starting to be asked to sub to teach classes, which was kind of ridiculous because how much experience did I have? But it was just the consistency of me being at the studio. I was literally there every day, sometimes twice a day. And one of my friends who is in the Ashtanga world, most people know him, Todd Bowman, was like, oh, you should take, oh, I just met this woman. She was in Mysore. She was doing third series. I don't think anybody really knew who she was at the time, but it was Keno. She was coming to do a workshop in Chicago. And he's like, she's super strong, young woman. She's right up your alley. So I said, okay, let me do this. It did take a bit of convincing because I was not that into doing workshops because all my experience was workshops, was just people getting kind of more in that academic world that I was trying so hard to like get the hell out of. And I just, yeah, I just wanted to practice. I didn't want to hear like a workshop. Jeez. But I went to Keno's workshop, and thankfully, at that time, it was exactly what I needed. She wasn't talking at all, which I think is very different than probably what is going on now. And I'm also guilty of talking a lot during my workshops. But at that time, she came. It was in June 2005. And she basically was just teaching practice. She did like a 20-minute Vipassana style meditation where it's just focusing on your breath. And then we would stand up and do primary series. And I think we did primary series like 4 or 5 times that weekend. There wasn't much workshopping going on. It was just practice.
It's like practice your ass off. Jeez.
Yeah. And it was great for me because I was like, oh, holy shit. And then at that time, I was actually able to do a lot more because I had been practicing all these vinyasa classes and really working on my flexibility. And so I was like, oh, I'm actually doing this. And I actually realized that I could do like a jump through. I was jumping through like straight legs, but I was coming up onto like my fingertips. And one of the things that Keno like called me out on was like, you know, you have to have your hands on the floor when you do that, right? And I was like, oh shit. Okay. Yeah. And so after that weekend, I was like, well, this is now maybe the only thing that was challenging me in that I felt truly challenged by was jumping through, jumping back. And I got kind of hooked on that. And I was like, okay, I'm going to really start doing this Mysore practice. And that's it. That's what I did. So I was,
wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I mean, and so from there, like you just did Mysore style the entire time.
Well, then after that weekend, I was doing Mysore style, and there were two teachers in Chicago at that time who were teaching Mysore. They were co-teaching. So it was two teachers in the room full of students. I was practicing for just a couple months with them, and they were already moving me through second series. Meanwhile, I couldn't remember the order of primary. And like I was on, I remember
bad
being,
student.
Yeah, bad. Like, but I was learning too quickly, and that wasn't, I didn't know that there was like a speed for this or whatever. Right. And, so they were teaching me a bit of second series after a couple months of practicing Mysore. And I remember like my legs shaking in Dhanurasana, and I was like, God damn it. My legs shouldn't be shaking. This is like supposed to be an easy pose, right? I was like drained. I was super exhausted. Good thing is that those two teachers left Chicago to go teach in Asia for a few months, and there was no program. The program was just gone. And I went into like a full panic because I was like, oh my God, I'm just learning this Ashtanga thing. I'm just starting to get into Mysore. And I wrote Todd a huge letter. He was in India at the time practicing with Sharat. And I wrote this huge letter, like, Todd, what am I going to do? Like full panic mode. And he was like, my whole long page email, he wrote like one line, which was like, take self-practice. And I was like, oh, okay. Oh, God. That like started a whole other wave of panic, but that's basically what I did.
Yeah, because self-practice is hard. It's really easy when there's people standing in the room.
Right.
You know, like those home practitioners, the people that are practicing in the shallow by themselves, like, man, yeah. It's brutal.
Yeah, it's brutal. I basically did like a full, I would say about a year and a half of practicing in classes and practicing with teachers to doing self-practice almost exclusively.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what you still do today too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, I practice by myself. I mean, I'm at my studio, but it's like, I'm by myself, so it might as well be a home practice. I'm just not at home.
Yeah. You know? I actually think that's a really important piece, is that if you don't have to practice in your house, don't.
Yeah,
like, if you can get the hell out, even go to a gym in the corner or whatever, like,
yeah,
I would definitely do that. Yeah.
I mean, your dishes are dirty.
Yeah.
And you can't do yoga. Like, your laundry's dirty. You can't do yoga.
Yeah.
Like, you know, phone rings, can't do yoga. Dogs come and bark or some post, you know, it's like there's so many distractions at home.
Yeah, there are.
So, yeah, I totally agree with you for sure.
Yeah.
So you did that for like, you know, you did that for a year. And then what happened after that?
I just started doing a self-practice and that was it. And then I would do whatever I could. Like whenever like there was Ashtanga teachers or workshops or whatever, I would take them. If I started traveling a bit, I kept practicing with Kino for a good time, which meant that I would see her like, you know how it is, like maybe once or twice a year. Sure. And I kept being encouraged to go and practice with Sharat. Or at the time, Pitabi Joyce, he was still alive, but just barely hanging on. And I really did not want to go to India.
Like,
I just did not. First of all, I barely traveled at that point in my life. I was really afraid of flying. There are so many reasons. I had total germophobia and I was like terrified of the level of cleanliness that I was.
Hate India. How did you go for so many times?
It took me a long time. I was practicing for 6 years before I took my first trip to India.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez. And I mean, you had to bring hand sanitizer, right?
I had brought so much stuff. I brought my own.
They do have this thing called Dettol, which basically kills everything.
It does.
There, but yeah. But I brought hand sanitizer too, just for the record. But
yeah, yeah. So yeah, I started practicing in 2004, and I didn't go to India until 2010. So by that time, I had completed second series. I was working on the usual things that one might work on when they're learning second series. I was working on lifting a Krandavasana consistently. Kapotasana wasn't much of an issue, but at that time, but you know, there's always work to do. So I was doing all that stuff. And then I went to India and you know how it is. You go to India and you start over. Yeah. So then that's what I did.
Yeah. And so what was your like experience during your yoga practice? Like, I mean, was it all about the challenge? Because I've heard you mention like challenge a few times. Was it all about challenge, or was it about like you finding peace or getting more connected to your body, or like what was your experience with it?
Yeah. I mean, why did I keep doing it?
Yeah.
Well, I think you said it all. Yeah. It was a challenge. It was definitely a challenge. There was like definitely this element of physical discipline that had been missing from my life for so long. And I was terrified of reverting, of going back to just being kind of complacent, slow, sluggish, tired, chubby. I was afraid that if I took off just even a couple days, if I took off, that I would just lose the will to go back in the room. So I just practiced. Like a crazy person. Yeah.
I mean, do you think that like, you know, the philosophy of like wanting to be challenged, because I experienced this as well. Like I prefer to be challenged, but do you think that at any point that like kind of runs you raw? Or like got you to a point where it was like, it wasn't fun anymore?
Oh, there was so much of the time that it wasn't fun. Yes, for sure. But I think that like, whenever you have a challenge, the challenge is the hook. That's the thing that keeps you coming back, because you're like, oh, I couldn't do that So I'm going to do it. And then you keep trying to do it and you keep trying to do it and you keep trying to do it. And that's what gets you actually to come back, is that you want to be able to achieve something that you couldn't before. So I think it's a really important piece of at least a committed practice. It doesn't have to be a daily practice. Now I realize that, but I think it is an important part of committed practice is one, challenge, and two, that there's some level of achievement. You can't keep practicing something over and over and over again that you're failing at. So you have to achieve, even though like maybe it might be against some yogic philosophy to say, oh, like you shouldn't be attached, non-attachment. You shouldn't care about the results. But actually we do care about the results, because if you're not getting results, why the hell are you still doing it? Do something else.
But I do feel like, and this is just my perspective on it, I feel like people get something out of it. Of course there's a challenge, but like, let's say they plateau, but there's something that they're getting out of it that is not in the physical aspect of it.
Yeah.
I mean, do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And you spend most of your physical life on a plateau, whether you're practicing yoga or whether you're Usain Bolt training for the Olympics, you're plateaued the majority of the time. Really just get these little moments of peaks, but the rest of the, and then you get valleys, that the valleys are awful, but then
those are terrible. Injuries and pain and all that stuff. That's where the valleys are. I know that too. Yeah. Well,
but you know, this isn't unique to yoga. This is inherent in any physical pursuit. It doesn't. Totally. Yeah. It does
100%.
Not. Yeah. It doesn't have to be. It's not like yoga is special. Don't get me wrong, but it's not unique. Anything you can be, look at, like, I have a friend who's like an ultra marathoner, and I'm pretty sure he's a better yogi than me, though. I don't think ever done a down dog in his life. But so, you know, I think that you can get the same benefits from doing a ton of activities. It doesn't necessarily have to be yoga. It's just like whatever you want to call it. Yoga is the state of mind, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, good stuff. I mean, because basically like what it boils down to is like people's philosophy, because, you know, the other people that I've talked to like don't share the same sort of like they don't mention challenge. And so I hear challenge and it's like that's appealing to me, because like I feel like my whole life has been a challenge. Like it's all been an uphill battle of like trying to stay sober or living a better life or all of that stuff. And I feel like people can't relate to that, which you're kind of saying some of the similar things to me, that like I echo as well. But you talk to someone who, you know, maybe it's a certified teacher or another yogi or whatever. And it's like, it's almost like they don't want any challenge, or there's no ambition behind it, or that there's the loss of ambition or the loss of attachment or any of that stuff. And my practice has been really, I am attached to it. Like I do want an outcome. I do want to move forward, because it moving forward on my mat means that I'm actually moving forward in my life too.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so, yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from for sure.
Yeah. So, I kind of think that people claim that they're not interested and the results are a bit lying.
I mean, it's totally possible. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I just know that a lot of other yoga styles like look at us and, you know, we have so much discipline. We have so much like, you know, we're just kind of grinning and bearing it, and they think we're crazy, you know, or we say like, oh yeah, we like the challenge. And it's like, you know, for some people it's like, they don't want to hear any challenge. You know, it's like they just want to feel good. It's about being blissed out or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is a completely different even mindset that I sort of don't understand myself. So,
yeah. Well, there's lots of disciplines where you get, it's like you have to do that discipline work and that, and the challenge or that sort of goal oriented torture that we put ourselves through, again, whether it's yoga or anything, in order to experience the blissfulness that you, like, we know that that's kind of cliche by now, but like another thing that I just recently kind of got into the idea of is these Wim Hof cold water plunges.
Right.
And I can't tell you how much discipline it takes to like walk your mostly naked body into a freezing cold body of water and be able to stay even 1 minute. And you walk out, that there's this awful, painful, horrible part. And then you walk out and there's euphoria. It's amazing. Yeah. And I was like, oh, wow, I can achieve this, that sensation with 1 minute of work versus like the 90 minutes of yoga that I've been torturing myself with daily for 15 years. I'm like, oh, wow, I'm getting this experience actually right now. And all I have to do is like 1 or 2 minutes of work. Amazing. So yeah. you can get it in a lot of ways, that sense of like, oh, amazing, connected, yeah, totally connected to your body, totally connected to the world, whatever, the universe, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Well, okay. So let's talk about your trips to Mysore. You said you didn't like them. Actually, you didn't say that. You said you didn't like India, or at least you were kind of like, you know.
I was very apprehensive to go to India. Yes.
Yeah.
And when I got there, like definitely it was, that was a challenge in and of itself when I got there. It was totally foreign to me. As I said, I really hadn't traveled much at that point in my life. I was really afraid of flying. So imagine I hadn't gone very far from, you know, outside of the United States and Canada and Mexico. So it was definitely like a culture shock that I had been trying to prepare myself for. But, and then the other part of it, which was really, really hard for me, was that what do you do in Mysore? You wake up at whatever time, you're jet lagged, whatever, you wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning, practice at maybe 4 or 5 in the morning for a couple hours. And then what do you do for the rest of the day? 22 hours. Of like sleeping and eating. And Taylor, I'm going to tell you what, that was like, it was like me getting really close to that borderline edgy place of like, oh my God, I'm going to go back into this like lazy mode because all I'm doing is sitting around and eating, napping, sleeping, hanging out.
Right.
And I was like a workaholic at that time. I was like, oh my God, I need something to do. So my first few trips to Mysore, I did not know what to do with all that extra time. It was like really hard. I just fucked around, did exactly what I said, and just tried to deal with it mentally. And then the next couple trips, I only took 6 trips to Mysore, but the next last three trips were different, better. My third trip, I adopted a dog. So my third trip was like literally like raising a puppy.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And like every trip after that, I somehow wound up with some dog in my life, taking care of a dog or working or something like that.
That'll keep you busy.
It definitely, sure. It does. It does. Or I had friends with dogs or like whatever. We were always like doing something that was like involved in animal rescue. And then I started going to Gold's Gym. And I started, yeah. So that's,
so you're just working out and also doing yoga just to stay active.
Yeah. Just because like, I was like I was just like, if I didn't do that, I'd be like napping in the middle of the day. I'd be sleeping all the time.
Gotcha.
So I went, yeah, I literally was like going to the gym and spending
like 2 hours.
How would you not get sore?
And how would you like not get sore from Gold's Gym and then go in there and like do second or third or primary or whatever? How'd you pull that off?
I don't know. I just did it. Just shut the fuck up and do it. Just, just did it. I don't mind being a little bit tight or a little bit sore. So
yeah, I mean, putting your leg behind your head after doing squats is a difficult day.
Well, I'm not a big squatting person anyway.
Okay.
but yeah, no doubt. But I was doing more things like push-ups and upper body stuff and like all of that really speaks to complementing what I do in my yoga practice anyway, which is a lot of like, at this point, all I really do is just like cool vinyasas. That's all I care about. So, yeah, it was just like a lot of upper body stuff and then a little bit of running.
How did it morph just into cool upper body stuff for you?
Well, I'm sure that you realize this too, but like when you practice, the longer you practice, you start to realize that you just keep doing different variations of the same few postures, you know, like a back bend is a back bend is a back bend. An external hip rotation is external hip rotation, whether you're putting your leg behind your head or you're sitting in whatever pigeon, what people call pigeon stretch or whatever. So I realized like all I really need to be doing is like six or seven or eight essential movements in terms of mobility every day. And the poses can, I don't have to do the exact same poses or follow the exact same sequence. That sort of realization is actually relatively new when I actually started saying, you know what, I don't need to do this Ashtanga series and every day.
Right. We're going to get to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that was it. I just realized like I just kind of took like the essential movements, the movements that I felt like I really needed, and I do those. And truthfully, I've probably lost a little bit of quote unquote flexibility, but I feel so much better than when I was doing the exact same sequence every day.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So elaborate a little bit on this because, you know, like when we started the conversation, actually before it was even recording, you know, I told you like, you know, I've been reading your post on Instagram and I've been in, and it seems like you've almost had like a sort of a falling out with Ashtanga.
Yeah, I definitely have.
Okay. So you definitely have, but I mean, you know, but it's still what you're teaching though too, right?
Not exactly.
Okay. Well, explain it to us.
So I guess I do have a legacy of an Ashtanga teacher, and there are some things obviously that I really love and respect about the practice. And I can probably name those things for you pretty easily. One is the Mysore style, the Mysore method of teaching, which is essentially like doing a private lesson in a room full of people, having this teacher or coach that is working with you as an individual rather than this, you know, typical yoga vinyasa style or even guided style practice where everybody's doing these kind of moving like a school of fish, doing these kind of cookie cutter movements. So the Mysore style or that way of teaching, I think is absolutely wonderful. It's the best, in my opinion, the best way to actually learn or grow physically in a yoga practice or in any practice, any physical practice, is to have that like one-on-one coaching.
Right.
So that is definitely something that I've saved and maintained in my way of teaching. Of course, when I travel on occasion, people still ask me to do guided classes just for efficiency. And I have been doing that, but I've actually been stepping away from that more and more and more. The other things that I really like about it is that Surya Namaskar is actually a brilliant practice. So I still do sun salutations all the time, every day, more or less. And I keep that. And when I have a brand new student, I'll teach them Surya Namaskar and standing sequence. And there's so much that you can learn about a person and their body and their strengths and their limitations and really get a chance to see what they need help with. But I use it just as like a blueprint in order to start to help them really develop a practice that is unique to them. Another thing that I do is I'll take like sections of any of the series, first, second, or third. I never learned beyond that, so I'm just using those series. But you'll notice that those series, there are groups of postures that, like, for instance, there's Marichasana A, B, C, and D, which are all like do X, Y, and Z for your hips or whatever. There's a relationship that keeps all these poses together. Well, if somebody needs, let's say, to work on those specific movements, let's say really deep hip flexion or knee flexion or external hip rotation or whatever it may be with the lotuses, that might be a really good section of poses to work with.
Sure.
So I would do that for somebody and say, okay, well, this Marichasana is maybe a bit of a bad example, but let's say somebody has a really strong posterior pelvic tilt, which is fairly common in the Western world. there would be a lot of rounding in the back and forward bending, things like that. Well, actually, that could cause a lot of pain. So doing, let's say, the first 8 postures of intermediate series with modifications, however needed, that could be a really great sequence for a beginner, somebody walking in my door today, starting them with actually the first few postures of second series might be a better approach than starting with primary series, where no doubt that person will get stuck in Mari Chasana B or Mari Chasana D or Supta Karmasana, be stuck there for perhaps a lifetime and could be exacerbating some of that, the problems that they have from too much spinal flexion.
Yeah. I mean, I get, it just begs the question of like, I mean, it sounds like you're being more of like a trainer than like an Ashtanga teacher. Or a coach instead of a.
Yeah. I like the word coach actually a lot better than I like the word teacher. Definitely. I do. Yeah. There's something about like that teacher student that sounds like guru disciple. And there's already this like hierarchy that's involved in that relationship, that power dynamic.
Sure.
That at this point, looking back on all my relationships with all the teachers I've had, feels very uncomfortable to me. That I'm just like, you know what? Don't call me. I'm a teacher. I don't want to be your teacher. Let me be like your friend who can coach you because I've had some more experience in this area than you have. Or whatever. Maybe even friend isn't the right word. But
and why have you gotten so uncomfortable with that whole situation?
You know, that first of all, let me like say like the whole thing with the sexual misconduct that's happened in Ashtanga and all those things, I've never had bad experiences in my own personal experience with that. But what I have experienced is the environment in which something like that could happen. And I can see people ignoring it. That people become so hooked or so enamored with their teacher or this idea of, oh, like it happens with Sharat all the time. Like, oh, Sharat knows my name. Sharat called me out today. Sharat said, Sharat touched me today. Or like, it's like, well,
or ignored me.
Or yeah, or whatever. Right. Like so much. Yeah. Of course. Like, you know, people get so caught up. And if they, I've seen it and I've actually felt that way because it feels like, God, you're so special. Sharat knows your name. Like, wait a minute, you're in a sea of 300 people and Sharat knows your name. Isn't that special? Yeah, that's so special. And to me, I'm like, you know what? Of course, maybe we'll never be as quote unquote as big or popular as Sharat. So I'm going to keep my numbers relatively small, but I want to know everybody's name. I want to talk to everybody and I don't want to give everybody the exact same movements. And there's another reason why I've sort of diverged from the practice a bit is because I think that a lot of the movements are great in yoga and Ashtanga yoga, but doing the exact same movement every day, repetitive motion, we all know causes pain and injury. If you change your practice every other day or 2 days this, 2 days that, 2 days the other thing, if you're constantly switching that varied movement, you can progress maybe in a different way or whatever, but that it's the repetitive movement that causes such pain and injury. I'll give you an example. Let's say that somebody wakes up and has the same routine every day. They wake up, they brush their teeth, they get ready to take a shower, drink coffee, throw on their messenger bag, take the exact same path to the subway or to their car or whatever. And they're carrying their bag in a certain way. They're driving their car in a certain way. They stand a certain way. They sit a certain way. Well, if you repeat that movement, that pattern of movement over and over and over again, that person's going to wind up with some pain. That's what's happening in yoga, in my opinion, in a really like extreme way, because of course we're doing these really extreme postures. So I've sort of eliminated super extreme postures from my practice. And I've definitely eliminated the repetition. So I'm just like, I'm doing things that are basically now corrective for all the things that I've done before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and from my perspective and just like, I've never been in a class with you, you know, but I mean, I practice next to you or close to you or whatever. I mean, I just want to know how you go from like, what is the mixture between going from like where you're at now to where you were? Because I feel like everyone considered you a hard-nosed teacher that stuck to the tradition, that was in your face, you know, yelling at people. Like, I mean, how do you go from that to, I mean, because what you're describing is really like your own method, but also like a sort of an easier, softer way.
Yeah. I grew the fuck up. I grew up. Part of it was because I was like really disciplined because I needed it. I needed that in my life. And so that's who I was as a teacher. I was essentially trying to give people what I needed. I needed this like strict, hardcore thing. And because I think that I just read an article in Psychology Today called The Guru Syndrome, which I recommend reading. But basically what people do is, and I think that this is just a psychological need, is that we have imperfect parents, we have imperfect examples of love, and we have that as children. And when we go away from the parent, we look to replace that with a teacher, a mentor, a guru, whatever you want to call it. And it's like that thing, like, oh, Sharat know my name. Oh, Sharat touched me today. Oh, I got an adjustment today. Oh, Sharat smiled at me, or oh, he winked at me. Like, it's essentially that same feeling of getting love or affection from somebody older or a parent figure, and feeling this, oh, like special thing. So, what was the question?
Well, I mean, I just want to know how you go from zero to, you know, well, actually from 100, like discipline and teaching people so intensely and following the tradition, to going all the way to, you know, this easier, softer approach, or maybe like in your opinion, you would say it's a more efficient approach or something like that.
Yeah, it's efficient. It's definitely more open-minded, and I hope to completely get away from that idea of being this like guru or teacher or parental figure. Like
isn't transference going to happen though, Day? Isn't there always going to be like someone in your class, regardless of what they're or what you're teaching them, that is going to put you in that role?
Yes. And I completely, if I'm aware of it, try to reject it. I mean, of course, that's going to happen. That's human nature. That's definitely human nature. But
I mean, it sounds like you threw out the system because of, or at least you were thinking about that because, and came to all of these conclusions because there was that line of thinking. But that's going to happen regardless of where you're at, right?
Yeah, it could, definitely. But I don't have to encourage it or promote it as the correct way. I think that we walk into yoga, so many people walk into yoga regardless of the style. Like when I was going to my first vinyasa classes at Moksha Yoga, everybody was talking about, oh, well, my teacher and my teacher and my teacher and my teacher. And they were saying it like it was like, I don't know, like this like godly figure. Like it immediately attached them to this other person or this other entity or this other identity. And I was like, oh, I remember being a brand new yoga student and thinking, well, I want that. I want this attachment, this belonging, this sense of saying like, this is my thing. This is my person. This is my style. And of course, Ashtanga is such a strong practice in comparison to other styles of yoga out there that of course, that's what my, you know, that my personality was attracted to.
Yeah.
But I do think it's dangerous.
Why?
I think it's dangerous because that is the exact same mentality that starts to get people to forget about themselves, forget about their own bodies, forget about what they're feeling, and continue forging through this path that may actually be causing them pain. That may actually be putting them in a vulnerable situation that keeps people paying tons and tons of money and giving up 2 or 3 months a year of their time to working with a person who barely acknowledges them and may or may not know their name. Gotcha. That I think is dangerous. The other thing I think is dangerous is that, again, it is the same system that for so many years has completely overlooked any sexual misconduct from its teachers. I just watched the documentary on Netflix on Bikram. Bikram was way beyond. He was raping his students. But at the end, you see the interviews with the students, and they said, he just raped me in his living room or in his kitchen, and I kissed him on the forehead and say, thank you, good night. Like, that's that type of mentality of thinking that there is somebody who is so much better than you, smarter than you, more knowing than you are about your own body is where I think it gets dangerous, where even the people who, like, this, what we would call the senior teachers, the people who were learning, you know, back in the original days of Ptahbi Joyce teaching, and they were all aware of what was going on, and nobody said anything until maybe 4 years back. Like, that's startling to me. There was a lot of things that in that past, maybe in the past few years, that I was like, if that's what's going on, and I'm just hearing about it now, and I've been practicing Ashtanga for over a decade, what the hell? Like, how is this even possible? So yeah, when I heard the first accusations about that, I was like, really? Like, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was, it's just like, it's just like, how could, first of all, it's not because I couldn't believe it because I thought, oh, Ptahbi Joyce must have been such a great angelic person. It was because I couldn't believe it because there were hundreds of students around. How has it gone this long without anybody saying anything or saying it loud enough that actually people listen?
Yeah. Well, actually now they're saying that they were covering it up or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is even a thing that, you know, I think maybe some people should be held accountable for. But so, okay. So that's why you broke from the system.
That,
like,
and
because of those thoughts.
Those thoughts and one more, which is that, and that's kind of a larger issue that I think concerns everybody, but the one that really kind of concerned me, which maybe really got me thinking, like, maybe I don't need to do this anymore. Maybe I don't need to keep going to India. Maybe I don't need to keep spending my time and money doing something that I'm not really enjoying, is because initially when you do that, there's this like reciprocation in some way. And the reciprocation is for people like us, people with an authorization, people who are making their careers based on this style of yoga, what you get in return for the time and the money that you're spending to go to India to be one in a sea of people is that you're getting this authorization. You can put it up on your website. You can say, hey, I've been to, at the time, KPJ, AYI, I'm a authorized level 2 teacher or whatever it is. Well, one, everybody started getting authorized, which I think was already happening by the time you and I got authorized as well. Right. But sooner or later, everybody who made at least 3 trips got that authorization. Well, how much does it mean when everybody and their mom and my girlfriend who doesn't teach yoga also has an authorization? Why? Yeah. So why is everybody and their mother paying anywhere from $1,200 to $2,000 to get this authorization that sometimes they're not even using? But what does it mean? No, but none of us have actually been trained as teachers. So that's one. And then the other thing is, well, hey, at least you get the authorization. You can put it up. This is my accreditation. This is the work I've done. This is X, Y, and Z. Then Sharat started pulling the authorizations overnight. And it happened literally, it feels like one day there was the Me Too movement and accusations about Ptahbi Joyce. And then the next day, authorizations were flying out the window. Oh, one day you have it, the next day you don't. Well, was that a distraction from the Ptahbi Joyce thing? Was that Sharat trying to clean house? What actually was going on there? But as soon as I was like, you know what, people who I actually thought were great teachers, people who I thought were like seniored in, I'll give an example. Alex Medin, who teaches in Norway, I met him on my first trip to India. He was a certified teacher then. I don't even know when he got certified. One day woke up and his certification was gone. Mark Roberts. Mark Roberts is one of the best yoga teachers, I think, out there right now. And I don't know what he was doing, some back walkovers or some shit or some extra handstands on his Instagram. And then his certification was gone, not twice, but I think three times. So these are people who I always saw as being smart, great teachers, reverent students, always friends with the family. And I thought, well, if these people who are friends with the Joyce family, who are so reverent and kind, how is some asshole like me going to keep my authorization when I'm never reverent and I'm never kind with things I don't like? So I was like, I already had issues and run-ins with past studios about teaching things quote unquote differently. And for teaching handstands and vinyasas where maybe you shouldn't do handstands or whatever, which is such bullshit. Because Sharat doesn't like handstands, I'm pretty sure Batabi Joyce would have all of those like Chuck Millers and Eddie Stearns and Tim Millers. And look at those old videos of those lifts that some of those guys were doing. And I'm pretty sure they were allowed to do handstands in their Mysore practice. And now suddenly it's not traditional is another story. But I mean, what the hell is traditional anyway? But when people started, people who I thought were actually very nice and respectful of the whole quote unquote tradition or the whole system were losing their authorizations and certifications, I was like, well, shit, it's a ticking time bomb. It's only a matter of time. So why bother? Yeah. Let me just speak how I speak my mind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's funny too, because, you know, I've had a lot of the similar thoughts because, I mean, this whole year, I feel like I've just been going through this sort of, I don't know, reevaluation, you know, asking myself, what is tradition? Why do we teach one pose at a time? Why does someone get stopped at this? Like, why is there no modifications? Or why do we frown upon like using a block or a strap? Or why do we not do handstands? Or, you know, like, what's the relationship between teacher and student? And, you know, like I've been having all of those conversations. And I think a lot of people have. So it's been very interesting just to hear you kind of talk, because I mean, I feel like everyone has experienced this, on some sort of level. I sat there and I was like, what is tradition? You know, like why are we supposed to follow this thing? You know, and are we following it blindly, or is there some sort of smart, intelligent reason why we're actually doing this? And so I think everyone has gone through a sort of a reconnection or reevaluation, trying to figure out like what the way is like going forward, sure. Yeah.
I think truthfully, Taylor, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the way is that you make your own way. Like Taylor Hunt has his own special brand and interpretation of his experience in yoga, Ashtanga yoga, movement in general. That's your, and anybody else, name any other authorized teacher who we know and who we know is out there and put in the time, put in the work, put in the hours. Most of us without a quote unquote guru or teacher figure in our lives, let's face it, the majority of the year. And we've all developed our own experiences and our own relationship with the practice and with the postures and with the movements. And that's your, every person who teaches has their own brand of Ashtanga. Yeah. There is no Ashtanga. There's Taylor Hunt yoga. There's Dave Christensen yoga. There's Todd Bowman yoga and whoever else is out there.
Right.
Go to who you like.
Yeah. It seems simple, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I got one burning question that I don't want to like get off of here before I ask you.
Okay.
You were talking about the practice and you were talking about how like you're changing it for people so that it fits them. Mm-hmm. And the first question that I have to ask is, isn't it purely looking at it through a physical aspect? Like, isn't there like, I mean, because I think fundamentalist Ashtangis would say like, there's a recipe for this, like almost spiritual connection. There's a physical physical aspect to the spiritual connection. There's a mental benefit from doing that sequence on a regular basis. So that it becomes more of like almost a controlled experiment, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And so but what I'm hearing from you is that it's not, that's not on your philosophy at all. Like your philosophy is completely different. You're looking at only like range of motion.
I'm looking at range of motion because I feel like that's a big safety issue. I mean, if you look at all the articles that have been written in yoga in the past 20 years or so. Yeah. Everything is why yoga is dangerous, why you shouldn't practice yoga, why the, I mean, there's more articles, I think, about the dangers of yoga than the benefits of yoga, unless, of course, you're only looking at Yoga Journal articles or something like that.
Right.
But no, I don't think that there's some special formula or alchemy to doing this exact series and doing it 5 or 6 days a week. I think that I kind of already mentioned that, like, any physical discipline can turn into the right alchemy. Doing ultra marathons can turn into the right alchemy. Doing a half marathon, doing jumping in the cold water, all those things can be the right discipline and turn into the right formula for what we're all looking for, which is really, at the end of the day, yoga, right? Union, connection, connecting to ourselves, connecting ourselves to the world. So that's the yoga. Do it any which way you want. My issue is with the physical practice is, A, if this yoga asana that we're doing is supposed to benefit us physically, the best benefit is to switch up your practice or to specifically do something like, if you've already gone too far in one direction, let's say that you have a huge, horrible anterior pelvic tilt from years of catching, years of Kapotasana, years of TikToks, years of Scorpion, years of whatever, right, and you have incredible spinal extension. Actually, probably what you should be doing 6 days a week is spinal flexion and completely eliminate spinal extension from your physical vocabulary. But for somebody who hasn't had this like baggage of a physical practice, most people will just benefit from doing a varied postures from day to day. There are some that are harmless enough, but some of the really, really deep ones, I definitely don't think you should be doing on a daily basis.
Interesting. I mean, you've given me a lot to think about. And the last question is, are you happy today?
Yeah, I'm happy. Definitely happy.
You feel like you're in a good place with all of these revelations that you've had?
I feel, of course, when you transition out of anything from one phase of your life that was so all-encompassing and so consuming, practice yoga, teach yoga, talk about yoga, write yoga, save your money, go to India, practice yoga, all that whole thing that I was doing for 15 years, suddenly to step out of it feels like I was in like a dark room for, I don't know, days, and you first walk outside and see that there's a whole world out there. That's sort of what I feel like. And now the question is, oh my God, what do I do? What do I do next? And it's kind of interesting and fun to figure out and formulate and do it in a way that really like connects and works for people. But it's also like filled with all kinds of like anxieties or fears and
sure.
Yeah, but it's still, it's awesome. It's still exciting.
Well, I really appreciate you being on the show. I appreciate being a friend or and a colleague, and you did a really great job of articulating. I think a lot of people had, you know, based off of some of the Instagram posts, they just had like a question about like, you know, what is Day doing? And
yeah.
I thought it was essential to just like, you know, that's why I reached out. I was like, you know what, I want to talk to her. It's like, you know, I don't care what people are doing. I'm going to keep doing me. You keep doing you. It's like, and you know, so I think it's really important that, you know, you shared a lot of this stuff and, you know, people are coming to the practice and people are going from the practice and all of that stuff. And, you know, there's space for all of us.
Yeah.
There's definitely space for all of us. So I really appreciate being on the show today and you know, like sharing your thoughts and, you know, your processes on how things have changed for you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.